The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Rowntree. I am COO at ExchangeWire, and today I am joined by our head of content, John Still. Hello, John.
Hi, Lindsay. Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you, of course. And today our theme will take on a specific sustainability route because our very special guest is Laura Wade, who is VP, Head of Sustainability at Essence MediaCom. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Hi. Looking forward to a big sustainability-driven chat today.
Great. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it.
Brilliant. And so I'll kick off with our first story, which is around apparel and ESG commitments within apparel. So a study has shown that 4 in 5 UK consumers could boycott apparel brands that fall short on ESG commitments. So fashion brands must prioritise an environmental and social agenda in order to survive or risk losing a huge percentage of custom, according to new consumer research. So this study that was commissioned by e-commerce growth specialist Quickfy Digital and digital performance marketing experts Climbing Trees, great company name, identified that 81% of UK consumers will boycott apparel brands who do not prioritise sustainable fashion within the next 2 years, potentially having a detrimental impact on those brands who do not uphold their social and environmental responsibilities. The top reason was slave labour, was 49%, but use of wasteful packaging, lack of sustainable materials and fabrics, and lack of variety of sustainable fabrics were also very high on the list of reasons. So Laura, I want to come to you first, and I want to understand what role consumer demand can have in driving change in the way that these apparel brands are operating when it comes to their focus on ESG and specifically for you, of course, sustainability.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think taking a step back, I think, you know, I have stood up and presented about consumer demand. So Kantar research showed that 92% of global citizens want to be able to live sustainable lifestyles. So we know that those stats are out there. We know that's what audiences are saying. But I would say that we need to position consumer demand as the why we need to act rather than how we need to act. Because I think the challenge with consumer demand is people say one thing and do another, which is the value intent gap. And that's the conversation we tend to have a lot. And that tends to sometimes be a pushback as well. As to why we should act, because you've got audiences saying that, but you also have, you know, companies such as Shein that have seen that 840% growth in 2 years. So very quickly you end up in this tension of what people are saying and what people are doing. And I think as agencies and marketeers, what we really need to do is use audience insight and understanding to think about how we address what people are saying, the intent behind consumer demand. So for example, consumers want to live more sustainable lifestyles, but they don't know how. So what you see in that instance is people saying, well, product or packaging needs to be recycled. But in the fashion industry, that is the least of our problems. And that actually, that's where as marketers and agencies, we need to take a step back and start thinking about when it comes to ESG, we need to start with the science and the impact. We need to start with the facts and what we need to address to make that product sustainable. Because like I say, if we answered consumer demand and said, okay, we've made all our packaging recyclable and now all our products are recycled polyester, that is not addressing the problem of, you know, the water usage that is, you know, and water pollution in particular. Like you say, the human rights issues throughout the supply chain because it's so opaque. So then you start to go, okay, are we solving for what consumers think they need, or are we solving for the problem? And I think that's where agencies and data and insight really needs to be used effectively. So in my opinion, when it comes to looking at consumer demand, we need to look at the intent and say people want to buy sustainably. Also, we know, again, from the same sort of Kantar research, that 63% of audiences expect brands and businesses to help them take that action. They don't want to have to go and research or do a master's in sustainability to understand the impact of that product. They want to know in good faith that when they pick up that product, it's aligned to their values. And it's our duty to understand what those values actually need to be and how we can deliver against those. Otherwise, it's greenwashing.
Absolutely.
You know, if we're bringing out a green range of products but haven't addressed the major issues within the supply chain, that is greenwashing. Yes, it might help our growth and it might, you know, help our sales. But realistically, I think the time is coming now that transparency is going to be so vital. You can see it with fashion brands like Diesel bringing out the QR codes. You could see the supply chain you know, where the journey of that product. So you can see whether it's a factory that has high ethical standards and safety in place. You know, we need to think about, actually, as fashion brands, we know that waste is a massive problem. Like one, I think it's 100 billion tons of garments are made a year, and 92 million of those end up in landfill. So actually just saying, yeah, exactly, that's a massive problem. So when you start to look at the actual science and the impact, that should inform your strategy, because rather than releasing a green range, when you look at waste as the problem, then you start going, well, actually, we need a resale on our site. We need to help people send in products they're no longer using and refurbish them and resell them. We need to give people a virtual dressing room on their website. So we know that that will reduce returns by around 35%. And that starts to inform your media strategy rather than, like I say, using consumer demand as a blunt instrument to come up with all these different solutions. You really need to focus on tackling what the real problem is in your supply chain to make it sustainable.
I mean, that was a very comprehensive answer. And you know, really, really interesting, kind of the insights that you have. It's so fascinating to always hear what you have to say. Are you encouraged by the fact that things like sustainability of fabrics and recyclability of fabrics are coming up on the agenda of consumers when it comes to what is important to them when it comes to kind of buying fashion apparel?
100%. And I, again, back to the landfill point, what I'm more encouraged by is, and this is called out in that research, is the increase of secondhand and the increase of looking for secondhand garments and apparel. I think that's, and again, back to the resale point, we need to look at what the fundamental problems are and address that. And I think you can see it with stuff like Vinted, with eBay and eBay sponsorship of Love Island, all of these things. Like, this is the consumer behavior change that is our business. And this is what we should be looking at. How do we drive consumer behavior change that is in line with a net zero / climate positive society? And that for me is what's exciting about what we do, because we can look at the solutions that we're trying to create within the media and e-commerce landscape and address that in a meaningful way.
And eBay sponsorship of Love Island is a great example. And John, I want to hear from you, kind of, you know, for those that aren't aware that if anyone who watches Love Island, I have to admit that I do. I apologize to everyone who might judge me for doing so. I don't care. So within the ad breaks, you actually can see it. There's an ad that shows that the looks that people on Love Island are wearing actually were sourced from eBay and they were secondhand. And that is a really interesting way of being able to show, because if you know how Love Island's brand connections and brand collaborations work, they've done that before with people like Pretty Little Thing and name anything else, boohoo.com, for example, where you can go and get a certain Love Island person's look. To be able to do that on eBay is really, really interesting, and be able to kind of show that actually we can do all these things secondhand. John, from your perspective, what do you think, you know, as a great example of a brand really being able to understand and be able to communicate with a certain generation and help them understand the importance of this, a generation which arguably actually is very, very conscious, far more conscious of sustainability than maybe the older generations are. But what more do you think that brands could and should be doing to be able to communicate this and help consumers understand the importance of the huge carbon footprint of the retail industry?
Yeah, I think it's... that Laura covered a lot in there, and I think that
she certainly did. Yes.
Yeah.
whatever you can add, just anything. It's fine. A couple of words.
So I think it's a case of leading the way. I'm delighted that consumer demand could be a flashpoint, and you know, we've discussed before, Lindsay, that sometimes the only way that brands will ever learn is when they see their bottom line slashed. That's the only way. When they're hitting their pockets, then they'll think they have to do something, and that's a sad truth, because I'd love to see brands. And I'd love to see brands leading the way and actually not being, you know, driven by entirely by their profits, but also what's good, and telling consumers what they can offer them in a more environmentally conscious society. I think it's about choosing who you work with. I think that's a huge thing. eBay and Love Island was going to be my example as well. I think it's right. You know, no. It's just an excellent touch point on how a program and that has previously thrived on fast fashion using Pretty Little Thing and Boohoo, which has been mired in scandal for the last few years in terms of its own practices, and now partnering with eBay, showing stuff, showing that it's a recyclable fashion is also attractive, also desirable, has been a huge thing. And on our ESG panel in Singapore last year, we touched on this the onus being on the agencies and brands in choosing who they work with in terms of the examples, in defining their own practices. And I think that's what we need to see more of. I think consumer demand is encouraging. And, you know, 81% is, it's a great number in showing that people will really be thinking about what fashion they wear and who they buy from. And it's wonderful that that's there. But it's on the industry and on the brands to take that and realize that it's, you know, for the good of their future and for the planet, that they really should be looking into this and leading the way.
But this does bring me to another point, because you mentioned, John, about bottom line and profits. And actually, if consumers lead the change, it'll affect their bottom line. But also, certainly for public companies, the shareholders hold most of the power. So if the shareholders are seeing the bottom line be affected, they are the ones that are going to be driving the change. So actually, it does come back to money often. I mean, it has to come back to money. But there's also, you know, regulations coming in. And regulation means that shareholders have to act. So I don't want to sound cynical, but actually, what is ultimately driving it? Is it a consumer demand for change? Or is it the shareholders going, oh God, the government's making us, so we have to do this, or we're not going to get our dividend this year?
We've got a 7-year deadline in terms of the 2030. You know, we need to keep within net zero within our grasp. We need to stay between, you know, within the 2030 target of limiting global warming by 1.5 degrees. And as you say, you can see legislation coming in, but actually taking out all the ethical reasons why you would do this from a purely commercial imperative, change needs to happen, because supply chains have never been more pressurized. So back to sort of water scarcity point, you are building models, for example, in the fashion industry, you are building models on infrastructure that is at high risk from climate change and the societal impacts that we see across it. You know, so actually, purely from an investor perspective, and this is why sort of the TCFD is really important, the risk of investing money in businesses that are not adopting to a credible transition plan and recognizing the water scarcity, the food scarcity, the, you know, the forced immigration of people that are suffering from climate change at this moment, you don't want to invest in those businesses, because they are fundamentally flawed, because they are tied to an economic system that is collapsing. So take away any ethics. If you want to invest, you need to invest in businesses that are fit for purpose for a net zero society and are prepared and able to adapt and thrive in the face of climate and ecological collapse.
Interesting. On that note, I'm going to move us into our second story, which, because I don't, John, I mean, could you add any more to Laura's excellent explanation there?
No, I think the end of the world is a fairly decent full stop for that story.
Yeah, I tend to agree. Yeah. So we'll move on to Walmart now and more retail. Yay. End of the world, never mind. We must continue buying things. So this is around Walmart launching a high margin, high growth rate tech business for the retail industry, which could change the financial market perception of their growth and help them achieve a higher valuation than what they've been focusing on, obviously, for the past however many decades, traditional grocery retail. Armed with data from their 37 million daily global customers, that's a lot of customers, and one of the world's most efficient supply chains, Walmart has been rolling out a suite of omnichannel tech products. And in January this year, the retail giant announced it would make several of its fulfillment and delivery tech products available to other retailers via Salesforce's app marketplace. So Laura, again, I want to come to you. And again, you know, we'll obviously start from a sustainability perspective, but one thing that is interesting to me about this is the diversification of companies like Walmart that are going from, you know, physical on the shelf to moving to a digital world. And diversification for revenue is very, very important. What role could sustainability play in diversification for a company like Walmart that has been operating as it is for so many years?
Yeah. So I think it's evident, and we can see that retail media is growing at phenomenal rates. And you can see that with the prices of retail media skyrocketing. So from a media perspective, we can see the growth there. I think diversification is going to be key to, like, following on from my previous point, actually, in terms of where you're going to find your growth. We need to look for new revenues of growth. You can't rely on your old structures. And actually, you know, kudos to Walmart. They have science-based targets. They have a massive commitment to reduce their supply chain emissions by a gigaton by 2030. So actually, this is where I passionately believe sustainability can be the catalyst for innovation. And for example, moving away from products into services. So yes, there is a significant impact of data and the digital infrastructure in terms of carbon emissions. However, that is being tackled when we think about decarbonizing the grid system. So, you know, let's be positive, optimistic that that transition is happening and underway. And therefore, moving into the digital space enables you to decarbonize quicker, because we know that there's steps in place to decarbonize that infrastructure. But also, like you say, they are diversifying and reducing the risk of their business being reliant on groceries, which again is under a lot of pressure, as we know, particularly in margins, but also in terms of food scarcity and the disruption that happens within, you know, food supply chains, which we're seeing because of world events. So for me, I think sustainability actually enables you to look at responsible areas of growth and responsible areas of diversification that will give you a much more robust opportunity to thrive now and in the future.
Interesting. And John, from your perspective, I mean, do you agree with that in terms of sustainability being a really good opportunity as a route to diversification? And also, you know, what do you think this will actually do for Walmart? Will it elevate their status?
Yeah, I think there's probably a couple of contradictions in terms of the diversification, because we're seeing Walmart, you know, moving into this tech area, but Laura's touched on food scarcity and the need for a more sustainable outlook. But the diversification is also, for some of the major supermarkets, been into like instant gratification delivery. You know, we're talking about, you know, Tesco's gone into Whoosh, Ocado's gone into Zoom. They are promising deliveries in half an hour for a price. And that, in terms of diversification, is great for their business model. You know, they're filling in where Deliveroo and Just Eat jumped in during the pandemic to bring groceries. They've seen the niche, they've jumped on it. Environmentally, and Laura, I'm sure you've got a lot of points on this, environmentally not so sound. We're adding more fumes to the road. I'm sure there are electric deliveries.
Well, Zoom is fully bicycle, might I? As a regular user of Zoom, they only deliver via bicycle.
Well, good. Then remove half my point and congratulations to Zoom.
Yes, I should do that. I don't know about, I never even heard of Whoosh till you just mentioned it. So I can't speak for Tesco, but I can speak for Ocado and say I've only ever seen them outside my door on a bicycle. And they're around the corner from me, actually. So yeah, I see them quite a lot.
Well, yeah, you are an ethical consumer. And I retract my issue on Ocado. Speaking of Ocado, actually, I mean, they're known as a grocer and a delivery company, but they're mainly a tech company in terms of where their valuation comes from. Their proprietary tech in terms of packing, you know, their automated packing services, that's where a lot of their cash and a lot of their background is in. And so it's done them no harm. And I'm sure Walmart going into that area, I'm sure it does elevate their status. It does bring them into a new market and definitely secures a future, cements their place in the retail marketplace.
But for retailers like Walmart, and we're seeing the same thing with, you know, you mentioned Tesco's another good example, retail media and commerce media is a huge, huge area and everyone's talking about it. It's a massive area of opportunity for 2023 for brands to be able to really promote their products. From a digital perspective, obviously we're just adding more opportunity to run digital ads and more opportunity to put things out there that probably no one's seeing. What do we need to consider when it comes to the digital carbon footprint and how we're kind of, you know, investing potentially billions into retail media? What do we need to consider when doing so? What should grocers consider when doing so?
Yeah, so I think the way that we approach it is we have some core principles at Essence MediaCom, and it's sort of the first is reduction and regeneration versus offsetting. The second is sort of tackling or innovating for scale, challenging the status quo and robust and consistent data. And so we take that framework when we look at what sort of products or services we're developing. So if I was to apply that to this situation and go, right, well, where's the waste and where's the vanity data? So the first thing I would say is responsible use of data. in the sense of data storage, making sure you're cleaning data, making sure that you're not, you know, apparently, you know, over 50% of data is never used or applied. So what, you know, the energy used to store that is wasteful. But then when you talk about tech best practices, and this is something that's sort of accelerating and being driven by our decarbonisation program across Group M, is, you know, what is best practice in terms of programmatic advertising, you know, leaning out the ad tech, supply path optimization. How do we make sure that these new sort of digital platforms are putting best practice in place rather than adopting what has been a very wasteful and inefficient, when it comes to energy, process that we've had in the advertising industry? How do we make sure they leapfrog that and go into a much more leaner and lighter advertising structure? And I suppose just picking up on the other point that John made in terms of consumption, we do need to address consumption in the sense of we need responsible consumption. You know, as a food industry, something like that, we produce enough food for about 5,000 calories per person in the world every day. And obviously, for those of you that are into your fitness and nutrition, know that we only need between 2,000 to 2,500 calories a day. But we also have a situation where you've got 2 billion people that are malnourished and starving, and 2 billion people that are obese. So again, that's the sort of global north, global south divide. And actually, you know, we do need to think about responsible consumption and the consumption of the food that we are consuming, in terms of not only its environmental impact, but also its impact on our health in terms of obesity. So I think actually, and many, many of the retailers do have science-based targets. It would be interesting, and I would really urge them to take their UN Sustainability Development Goals they've committed to, their science-based targets, and apply that to the retail media that they are currently developing, and making sure that they're thinking about it holistically. And maybe not having the answers, but asking the questions about what does a retail media offering that is fit for purpose look like.
Interesting. And John, from your perspective, you know, Laura just said, what is a retail media offering that's fit for purpose? Fit for purpose from a sustainability perspective, but also fit for purpose from a consumption perspective, you know, thinking about kind of, Laura's mentioned quite a few times, having things that are science-based and science-backed. What role does the amount of data that we have access to for retail and commerce media play in ensuring that we are creating essentially a new media channel that we can try and kind of from the off make it as potentially sustainable, but also as efficient and usable as possible?
Yeah, I think that's one of the opportunities in commerce and retail media. You know, it's a burgeoning area that has made a lot of sense for a while, and it's reaching, you know, this is the year we've said that this is the year it's really going to break. And it's ensuring that that system isn't just repeating old mistakes. I think it's making sure that the data use is smart and is targeted and isn't just throwing stuff at the wall for the sake of it. I think the opportunity of retail media is it offers you that, it's built-in context. You have that already. You know that someone is actively looking for a product, and you place something next to it. It's what they're after, and it's really got that value for brands to be in the area. And it's about not repeating the mistakes, about not overusing or over-indexing, I think, their data use. And I'm interested to see how it plays out and how it can be used responsibly.
It feels like in the programmatic industry, certainly, we got to a stage where we for a good 10 years, we just because you can doesn't mean you should. Well, we can and we did. And now we've come back and gone, actually, we didn't need to do any of that stuff. Let's go back to basics. And you're seeing, you know, in terms of the measurement solutions, in terms of the targeting solutions, obviously, in terms of a privacy and identity perspective, it's becoming a, let's look back to the practices of 15 years ago and maybe kind of think a bit more about what we're doing. And let's not just do everything because it's possible to. Do we think that sustainability plays a role in that too, that actually that's going to help us be able to look back at how things used to be and go, we don't need to do this. Let's look at what is useful and practical as a solution. Laura.
100%. And I think just because we can, should we, is kind of a motto to all of technology that is coming, you know, to fruition at this moment. With sustainability, it's not necessarily having the answers. It's about asking the questions and saying, well, what if we do this, what is the impact? Does it drive so much more efficiency in terms of our deliverables that it means that we're using less energy because we're achieving our campaigns quicker, and hitting our KPIs? Or are we just adding in a layer of energy consumption that is unnecessary? Are we sort of creating vanity data by encouraging people to upgrade to 4K TVs? I mean, there's a stat, I think, that 4K TVs add 2p every day to your energy bill. So in a really simplistic way, you suddenly go, okay, is that worth it? We're in an energy crisis, you know, bills are going through the roof. Is having a 4K telly worth it? So again, sort of, I know that sounds really simplistic, but thinking about these things and saying, is that upgrade, is that upscale actually incrementally a better thing for us to have on all levels?
I'd argue if you're watching EastEnders, you probably can't tell the difference.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's the same with mobile ads, isn't it? It's like, do you need creative that is, you know, so, you know, high definition that it's not even discernible to the human eye, and then you're looking at it on your mobile screen? The energy that's gone into producing that and distributing that, it's just, again, it's, you know, we should have a bit of fun with this, not be too, you know, not feel too precious about our behaviors. We're all recovering hypocrites, which is fine. Just embrace that and start to go, actually, let's just apply some common sense here. Is this necessary, and does it add value? And with a sustainability lens, what is this impact on energy consumption?
We'll delve into your thoughts on this and more in the second part of the podcast. But for now, I'm going to move us to our third story, which is around AI and chatbots, obviously. So VC firm Andreessen Horowitz has led an investment of more than $200 million into generative AI chatbot company Character.ai, marking the early internet pioneer's first significant foray into the booming sector. The investment values the company at about $1 billion, and Character.ai was developed by two ex-Googlers who developed an AI tool a few years ago in Google, and everyone was so freaked out by it, they shut it down. So, and then Google kind of moved away from AI for a bit, and now obviously Microsoft and ChatGPT have picked up. So Google have gone, oh no, we must create this again. But anyway, these two guys have gone now, and they've created Character.ai. And it's an interesting one. So it uses large language models, much like ChatGPT does, the technology that underpins ChatGPT, to generate conversation in the style of various characters, including Tesla chief executive Elon Musk, Elon Musk, why not? And Nintendo character Mario from user prompts. So basically, you would go in, you'd say, I want to have a conversation. You create a character, I want to have a conversation with this character, and it will then have a conversation, and you get warnings on it, like everything the character says is made up. Don't trust everything they say or take them too seriously. Characters may be offensive. If they are offensive, please give them a one-star rating. And characters can be anything. Now, my first question, of course, is why? John, why?
That's my question as well.
Okay, good.
I'm really intrigued by this generative AI, the boom in this that we've seen this year since ChatGPT came out last year. I find it an absolutely fascinating area. I'm interested in the possibilities. We'll touch on everything it can bring to the creative industries, I'm sure. But this was the first story that I've read that made me say, why? Exactly like you did. I understand the need for chatbots and the use of them. But there's so many questions this brings up in terms of generating conversation in the side of someone else. I want to know about copyright law. I want to know more about defamation. I want to know more about the imitation that it offers, despite what guardrails it has and what it's saying, you know, don't ignore these or give them a one-star rating. Technology that can do this. I had a book a few years ago, which was hip hop lyrics written in the style of Shakespeare sonnets. And that seems to be a lot of what ChatGPT ChatGPT can do in terms of mimicking styles. I don't want anything written to me in the style of Elon Musk particularly, or Mario. So this is what made me think, okay, now we're seeing some of the aspects of the bubble here. This is stuff coming out with insane valuations because it is generative AI technology that perhaps doesn't have the practical use. It, I think generative AI has an incredible potential in terms of practical use cases as a creative tool and a creative assistant. But it's things like this that make me think that, yeah, we're at the top of a hype cycle now, and there are going to be businesses that are insanely valued and insanely invested in, and we will see that bubble burst in a number of years, if not months.
Interesting.
Why a Mario chatbot was the first question. But no, I think there's a lot to the story as well.
I mean, do you think that obviously they had to try and create something that was not just a standard AI generative communication tool like what ChatGPT is, because they already exist and they've already been used and picked up by obviously the likes of Google have built Bard. Originally it was Lambda. And obviously Bing, Microsoft have bought ChatGPT, invest in ChatGPT. They had to create something different. Otherwise, it's just another same thing that does the same thing. Do you think actually this is a good example of where they can encourage users to go and try and create different characters and then use those learnings from what the different users are creating to understand how they could then maybe use that for brands? So brands could insert certain values into what they want to be able to communicate, and then they can have chatbots that can communicate with somebody in a certain way and deliver a certain message and provide certain information that would actually could be very much on brand message. And this could be a way of trialing that. I don't know, I'm just putting that out there.
No, I think the learning point's a really important one, because that's what this is all about. This is what the generative AI is doing. It's constantly learning. It's being taught on a variety of different information, a lot of different information. And it is, maybe why stuff like this as a diversification is quite early, because we've seen from Google Bard that it was released to great fanfare by Google and overnight had wiped half the company's share price off it because it had given a very wrong answer to which was called out by actual scientists. And so the initial wave that we saw from the big companies, from Meta, from Google, from OpenAI, from Neva even, from Baidu, is that's still learning, and that's still, it's interesting that there's a diversification like this already. But yeah, in terms of brand communication and how, you know, what they could bring to their audience, it's interesting learning from what characters would say, how that would interact. Interesting to see what the practical use cases for this actually are.
And Laura, what, if anything, can AI do for sustainability? She's laughing, so this is going to be a good answer.
Well, no, I've got, so I could go off on so many tangents. So randomly, I listened to an energy transition podcast because my role in sustainability, my background is media, so I'm constantly trying to upskill. And I was listening to how sort of AI will be essential in terms of helping to optimize our energy grid system. And they were talking about why it's so necessary. And this was a very renowned scientist talking about this, and the interviewer was asking her, but, you know, obviously with all this technology, there is a downside. What do you see the downside of AI? And I was expecting her to talk about something to do with energy. And she just turned around and said advertising, which, you know, was a big poke in the eye, because I was like, oh, right, okay. I thought I was in a safe space here where I could just learn. So I think, that's just a little example of, I think, with great power comes great responsibility. AI generally, I think we need to consider security, safety, ethical and governance questions. And again, the people who are creating this, and like you just inferred, we all sort of go along, interact with this stuff for fun, but actually what data are they going to use it for? How are they gathering it? Are we the unpaid workforce that are helping design something that is going to be used in the future? I would say the one thing that kind of piqued my interest in this space in terms of generative AI was about how people were starting to make the case, environmentalists were starting to make the case of how it could be used to bring the voice of the planet into boardrooms. So, okay. So if you're talking about investment or you're talking about new product development, could you have generative AI that is the voice of, you know, whether that's the, you know, if you were, for example, if you're thinking about putting, this is just an example I'm making off the top of my head, but if you were thinking about where you're going to put your wind turbines, you might have the voice of the ocean and the whales going, well, that's our migration route. We don't want, like, that would impact us negatively. Again, that's all about who's inputted into it. And I know this isn't an advertising conversation, but for me, that piqued my interest. Is there a chance for AI, if it's well considered and the input is credible, to help us consider different perspectives that we don't get to hear and different voices that we don't get to hear in the decision-making process within advertising, marketing, and beyond within business? So that's kind of probably my sort of point on that. I think there's massive potential, and it's just, again, bitchy or just because we can, should we? It's like, how do we use this for good? How do we actually use this in a credible way to create credible impact? And I know on a smaller scale, as Essence MediaCom, the team have been looking at AI for, you know, for years now in terms of what that means for content generation, task automation, human representation, and predominantly predictions from data. But that doesn't make the headlines, because that's far less sexy than, you know, making a famous person voice.
Oh, that's boring. Yeah, if you can't have a chat with Elon Musk, then what's the point of it?
Exactly.
But so, yeah. You do raise an excellent point, though. Kind of the AI has been given kind of a real boost in terms of headlines recently because of the gimmicks that exist around generative AI. But actually, we've been using, you know, AI and certainly if not AI, advanced data programming for many, many years, and definitely in advertising. And the role of that in advertising is underplayed quite a bit. But as you said, Laura, kind of what you're looking at in Essence MediaCom in terms of how to make your jobs more efficient and more easy. And we've discussed it in Exchange Wire as well, talking about from a journalistic perspective, would publishers use AI to be able to write articles, allowing their journalists to go and do the real meaty stuff rather than, oh, so-and-so down the road pop their clogs. What it can mean for the future of humanity, really. I mean, I hadn't considered, you know, should we build something there? Well, let's ask the whales. Let's see what the whales think. I hadn't really considered that being a potential option. So it could go anywhere.
But I think that probably highlights the bubble of the tech industry and who's programming and who's creating the AI, because I think if you gave it to some indigenous people or people, or, you know, I just think there would be so much, there's so much more breadth of diversity of voices that could be used to inform these tools on a bigger scale, you know.
Well, that's come up too, hasn't it? You know, diversity, yeah, around who's building these programs in the first place. Obviously, a lot of people from the Asian continent kind of work in tech, and they're saying, actually, are they the ones driving some of the voices that we're seeing in this in generative AI? And actually, are we hearing from everybody? And it ties in with, there used to be apps out there, I think Microsoft Bing had one that was like, you know, facial recognition. It could only recognize certain faces, could only recognize certain voices. And you know, this comes into play as well in terms of who's creating it and what do they see to be normal. And we can't be looking at things in that way. I've gone off a tangent, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that's the whole thing about sustainability. It isn't just about the environment. It is about how do we make it an exclusive and equitable world for everyone, and that everyone has access to tools that will enhance their lives. And also we have greater diversity of thought and voices. So it's something that I'm quite passionate about.
Absolutely. John, any final words from you on the AI bubble?
No, just I think in terms of the ad industry and maybe how we can, you know, how it will aid creativity. I had a fascinating conversation with a creative director recently who was saying that what it's really good for in his industry at the moment is giving out bad copy. So basically you could input something for your campaign, and what it gives you back is every single cliche in the book. And so he's using it as a way to inform his team in a way not to write, and how to be a bit more creative than the standard cliches, because it's learning on, you know, 50 years of cliched ad slogans. And so I found that fascinating, that at the moment it's an informative way of not doing the wrong things.
That's
but
very
no,
useful.
Yeah, it's no, it's I think it's all very fascinating. But Laura's points, yeah, I think giving that voice, it's an area I hadn't considered and a fascinating one.
Indeed. And on that note, I'm going to move us on to the second part of the podcast, which is we're going to find out more about you, Laura, and about your sustainability journey. So what I'm fascinated by, you mentioned already that you have a media background. What got you into sustainability? Talk us through your sustainability journey. I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I have worked in the content space, so content partnerships, sponsorships, for the last 20 years. And I think as part of that, you're constantly immersed in what are, you know, what are consumer trends, what are influencing culture, and working with clients to try and help them ingratiate with culture or even, you know, drive cultural trends. And for me, it just felt like there was a, you know, a massive signal that the climate crisis and the ecological crisis is the context we are operating in. And it was just very random. I went and spoke to the CEO and said, I just think this is a, well, not random, obviously I thought this through and pitched it fully.
Woke up one day and thought, I'm going to go speak to the CEO today.
So I did a lot of thinking. And again, I went back to what are my core values. And something that I realized is that a lot of my core values, when I look back at my childhood and my early adult life, were very much about campaigning and environmental issues. You know, I was a child of the ozone layer. So, you know, that kind of, you know, we all buckle down and we solve a problem for the global community. And for me, I was just like, this feels like a no-brainer. This feels like this is going to revolutionize our clients' industry, but also our industry. And so I went and pitched to my CEO at the time. And I think there's something to be said for synchronicity in the fact of once I'd realized that, I suddenly saw a colleague of a colleague post something about a course they'd done at Cambridge on sustainability. So when I went in to talk about this, I also had an ask and said, I'd love to do this course. And he stopped me halfway through the pitch and said, I can absolutely see you doing this and we'll pay for the course. So I went and did the course, and off the back of the course came up with quite a, well, I'm going to say this because it was my work, but a robust media, not media plan, robust business plan on how I felt that we should be integrating our sort of a framework for a sustainable transition. And then if you think of what's running in parallel to that, you've got WPP announcing our science-based targets, GRIPM sort of the decarbonisation piece. And for me, my role is very much about how do we manifest those targets into actions and mindsets within the agency? And how do we influence the work that we are producing? And as you might have already gathered from this podcast, I generally come into meetings and throw curveballs and just talk about random things and suggest, should we be looking at this differently and really having different conversations and also trying to, you know, the reality is most of us can see this happening around us outside of our work. And if we have family in other regions or countries, we can see the impact of it. So actually helping people address that tension in terms of what we know is happening in the world, what we know needs to be done, and the work that we are doing, and whether it's playing a negative role in continuing to push the status quo and consumption, or can we flip it on its head and be the catalyst for the change that we need to see in consumer behavior? So I love my job now. Not that I'm saying I didn't love my 20 years in media before, it was a learning curve. But now I feel really excited because I feel like our industry needs to change, and we all need to be able to have those conversations and see people go from skeptic, cynic to excited. And thinking about new solutions is brilliant.
Have you seen that journey as well in Essence MediaCom? Like, have you, from the beginning, was it like, oh, bloody hell, Laura's here again, banging the sustainability drum, eye rolling, like, what do we have to include in our campaign now to actually, yes, sustainability first approach to advertising?
Yeah, look, I've only been in the role 12 months. So, you know, and with the merger as well, I think, you know, there's thousands of people to reach. But yes, I would absolutely say that. And I, you know, actually, The area that sort of happened very quickly was actually in the programmatic and ad tech space. And again, I was talking to multiple, and I think you can spread yourself far too thin in this kind of role where there's so much that we can do. So again, a good place to start is, well, where is our passion point? What are we proud of? And obviously, in essence, the data and the programmatic part of our business, you know, we do everything else, but it's a key skill set, and we're industry leading in that. So sitting down with Matthew McIntyre and Mark Bulling, who's our global product lead, and saying, hey, so programmatic, how do we make it more sustainable? And then having to spend quite a few hours drawing the supply chain to me and me going, this is hurting my brain. Why is this so complicated? And like, yeah. I said, how do we reduce that? But why would we do that? Why do we have non-viewable ads? And what is that not waste? And having those conversations and actually going from a conversation like that to then a workshop where we're all sitting there going, well, actually we need to be able to understand the carbon footprint of an impression to be able to then work out what a strategy of reduction would look like, to, you know, getting on a call and Mark talking about carbon trading, because he'd gone off and he'd gone and started reading into it, and, you know, and just seeing that transition. And now, you know, Matt could be on this podcast having the same conversation with you. Mark could be in there. You know, it's them start, you know, they're brilliant. And I think that would be my sort of learning, is that you don't need everyone to be sustainability experts. You just need to have the conversation with them, and they are experts in their fields. And suddenly if you give them a basic toolkit or a basic premise or principles, and you explain to them the impact that tackling those principles could have, you just watch that turn into enthusiasm and innovation. And like I say, we've created a sustainable programmatic framework now, and now it's about scaling that across Essence MediaCom globally, and then throughout Group M. So you start to see how that one project can become quite impactful, and hopefully, you know, have really interesting conversations within the programmatic industry as a whole.
And, you know, we all know that the programmatic supply chain is a complete mess. There's far too many players in it. It's far too messy, far too many moving parts. We know there's a lot of wastage. You just mentioned non-viewable ads there. That's only one tiny bit of the wastage that we see in this industry. Do you think that, but we've all kind of gone, oh, well, let's just brush it under the carpet, it is what it is. And yes, 50% of our ads are viewable. The other 50% weren't. That's fine. 50% people saw our ads. Great. That's a really good result. Do you think that the sustainability angle and thinking about it from that perspective and what that wastage means for the environment will help us all as an industry think differently about what that wastage looks like, and not just like, oh, well, because it's tied back to money. And that does make a difference. Brands go, I've just wasted $1 million on nothing because those ads weren't seen. But even that doesn't really move the needle as much as it should do. Do you think that sustainability and the future of our environment will help it move the needle even further?
Yeah, so we have got a case study for one of our brands using the carbon emission audit that we now run via Scope 3, which I know has partnered with a lot of suppliers within the market. But we're able now to automate a report for our clients. And using that report, we were able to identify the high carbon, low performing sites within their buy. We removed about 10% of the domains, so we just raised the floor. And you can tell I've been hanging out with programmatic people.
I really can, that. Yeah. Talk about floor raising. Wow.
and then what happened was we ran that campaign and we saw a 29% reduction in carbon, but a quadrupling of conversion.
Wow.
So you suddenly then start to come up with more, and you know, that's one campaign. And we need to create much, you know, we need to replicate that again and again and again and try hypotheses. But you start to build hypotheses off of the data and you start to think about, well, what if we try this? And it's kind of like these incremental steps. And what I would also say is, again, just going through that process, the team know that now they don't run the Scope 3 reports all the time. They don't run them in real time. You can run them daily, but we don't, because we've seen that the data doesn't really shift that much. So we're really conscious of doing the run once. You know, we're thinking about our own energy consumption when we're actually pulling that data and how we're running it as well. So it's kind of becomes this ethos that not only the deliverables, but our behaviours around that campaign and how that can, you know, inform our behaviours and ensure that we're not using a solution to, because sometimes what can happen is you come up with a solution, all it does is it pushes the energy consumption or the environmental impact down the supply chain or onto another part, which defeats the point. Actually, we want to achieve reduction. So having technology like Scope 3, we also need to make sure that we're not sort of running campaign requests willy-nilly, because that, again, that's wasteful. So back to my original point. So far, tentatively, and I'm sure there will be outliers that prove this wrong, but we are seeing performance increase with carbon reduction through the strategies that we're adopting,
which is amazing. And so do you think that what the aim for the industry should be, that we that the carbon footprint becomes an actual kind of fundamental part of the measurement cycle, like an actual it should be a KPI, as much as viewability is, as much as the, you know, as much as attention metrics are, actually should be almost like a hygiene factor when it comes to running any campaign.
Yeah, it will be. If you look at our science-based targets, so for WPP, which covers all of us, obviously they're our holding group, 98% of our carbon emissions come from scope 3, which is our suppliers. And of that, sort of 54-55% of that is the media we plan and buy. And we've committed to reducing that by 50% by 2030. So therefore, you can only reduce what you can measure. So carbon budgets and carbon accounting and carbon measurement is going to be mainstay. It's going to be table stakes over the next 2 to 3 years. So I think the really important thing is, again, this isn't about, you know, creating standards that are really difficult to achieve. This is about how do we collaborate as an industry and get to a point that we have a trusted methodology, we have a trusted metric, and we're all aligned on what the ambition is, i.e. reduction versus offsetting. So, yeah, I mean, if that hasn't happened within the next, you know, 12 to 18 months, then I think we will have failed as an industry to really grasp what is required of us.
Wow. On a much cheery note, run out of time.
Sorry.
But I've said, no. We need to be, I mean, you said earlier, we need to have fun with it, right? Like you don't want to be the person that's doom mongering and going, if we don't fix things now, the world's going to end. We need to actually to almost gamify it in some way to ensure people actually engage with it.
And like, why do we get into our jobs? We want to be challenged and we want to be curious and we want to innovate. Business as usual isn't innovating. And that's why I think sustainability is a brilliant catalyst, not only for innovation, but also feel good factor. So why not do it? Why not lean into that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a much more positive note to end on. We are out of time. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really, really interesting.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Excellent. And John, of course, as always, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
This has been the Mad Tech Podcast. Thank you for listening.